If I put this on the screen right now, this is a terrace in Paddington that just sold for $9 million all over the news. I'm sure people have already seen this. You're trying to tell me this is normal, Cameron. I feel like I'm in a Ponzi market, and all I'm getting from you this morning is it's normal, Matt. Deal with it. I mean, even incomes are not right. Real incomes are not rising at the same rate as inflation, right? That's the data I'm seeing, Mr. Economist.
Well, I think by 2027, our main complaint about housing will be that rents and prices are falling, not rising. Everyone's got their interests. Oh, it's a housing crisis. Remove taxes on property because I'm a developer. There's a crisis, don't you know? Someone else, it's a crisis. Rent control. It's a crisis upzone. It's a crisis. I don't know. Everyone's got their thing, right? And it's so weird that we have, for example, landlords saying, oh, no, don't regulate rents because, that'll backfire and rents will go up. I'm like, hang on a minute. You make money from higher rents. And if it really backfired, wouldn't you lobby for it to get the higher rents in the future? Like, it's just everyone's got these weird stories they tell.
What do you think of the narrative floating around that the high immigration is a deliberate policy to pump up GDP and housing prices, both from a political point of view and like a personal, they don't want to see GDP go back on their watch, elbow, but also to generally keep typically the boomers and the X generation, who are the ones who own the homes, more so than millennials, but just to pump property prices. Is that true in any sense?
Well, what do you think, Matt? It sounds pretty plausible to me.
Okay, everyone, rents are up, prices are up, house prices, everything is up. What is going on? Well, if you've been watching the Discernible interviews, you would have seen Dr. Professor legend Cameron Murray, who's on screen right now. He was the only economist I saw who predicted in the height of the dark times, the COVID era, or rather the government's response to COVID. He's the only one that predicted that prices of homes were not going to go down. In fact, there'll be a 20% rise, and that's exactly what we've seen. So he's back today to talk to us about this new book he's written called The Great Housing Hijack, where we all know there's something wrong with the property market, or we think so. There it is, The Great Housing Hijack. And he has gone and applied data to it. He's researched, he's applied data, and he said, well, this is how prices work, and this is what we can do to fix it. So, Dr. Cameron Murray, thank you for coming back on Discernible for, I think, the third time.
Oh, great to be back, Matt. Always good to chat.
Oh. How about I start like an ignorant fool, and you can disabuse me of my notions.
Let's do it like that.
Let's do it like that. I look around and I go, how is it possible that house prices are so out of control? And yet, you know, in your book, you talk about as far back as 1872, where they were talking about a housing shortage back in Marx days. So this is a long problem. There's something systemic. Something structural, the way that housing goes into shortages every now and then. What is this dynamic that we're experiencing right now?
Yeah, well, I guess the way I put it is housing markets are doing what housing markets always do. And periodically they adjust rapidly, they have a cycle, but they don't trend too far from this sort of long run, what I call equilibrium pricing, either in rents or in asset prices. And yeah, so houses prices are doing what they always do. We've had a lot of income growth, a lot of inflation. What happens? Prices and rents go up. It's happening in every city around the world. What happened in the 1880s land boom in Victoria? Prices went up. Everyone's income was rising. They bought more houses. Rents went up. One of my favorite quotes about Sydney is the number of new buildings recently finished is truly astounding. Nevertheless, everyone complains about the high rents and difficulty in procuring a house. Mm. Now, you could have written that today about Sydney, right? That was Charles Darwin in 1836 when he arrived in Sydney on the HMS Beagle on his travels around the world, coming up with the theory of evolution. He arrives in Sydney. Before he writes about any animals, first paragraph, first day's diary, the people are complaining about housing, yet there's great houses everywhere. There's only 20,000 people. What's wrong?
Indeed, so what is wrong?
200 years later, the same complaints. What is wrong? Well, nothing's wrong. This is what markets do. If you look historically, markets always go in cycles. As incomes rise, they always track household incomes. So some people don't believe me when I say that rents compared to household incomes are about 20%. So your after-tax household total income, on average across the market, people pay 20% in 2001. 2021, according to the census. But in 2001, they also paid 20%, according to the census. And in 1991, they also paid 20%. That was the first year we have good records. But if you go back, there was a 1910 New South Wales inquiry into the trouble of rising rents. And if you go back to the 1910s, 1920s, 1930s, and you try and estimate wages and rents, you'll see it's roughly 20% then as well. So we've got this 100-year period of essentially people spending the same share of income on rents. And to me, that suggests, well, the housing markets always do. And that's what they're doing now. And we complained about it every few years. We had the 1910 inquiry. We had a 1919 federal inquiry, the Piddington inquiry. We had a 1930s, many inquiries during the Depression, many inquiries in the 70s. We've had it. The same issues forever, and because this is what markets do. So I think the debate we have often is about there's something wrong with the property market. We've got to fix it somehow. And I'm like, no. If I look at history, if I look abroad, if I look at online computer games that have housing markets, I'm not sure if you noticed that part in the book. Let me quote to you because it's pretty... It's pretty interesting that when you replicate a housing market in a computer game, an online world, you get the same housing crises, unequal access to housing, rising rents, and even digital recessions.
Wow.
So, okay, so if our problem is the market's doing what it's doing, what should we do? And I think we're also missing that the market works for most people. This is the other... Most people are homeowners, right? 67% of us, market's working fine. Prices go up, we're happy. 18% of households are landlords. Rents go up, they're happy, right? So the market's only not working for a small number of proportion of households.
Okay. Before we move on.
That's worth keeping in mind.
Yeah. Before we move on, you have to convince me of this bit first, because I'm not convinced that the housing market is fine and there's nothing wrong with it. And a bunch of people have either clicked off already or they're with me saying, Cameron, what are you talking about? What about things like the share? You say the share of income hasn't changed to spend on housing, but what about the average, the multiple of income? So we've seen the average house was 4 times income back in the day. Now it's 8 times, that kind of thing. Is it not getting harder to own a home?
Well, there's two things. So I would say in response, firstly, the last 5 years have seen more first home buying than the decade before. So if it's harder now, then I don't understand why we have more first home buyers than we did during the 2010s. Secondly, the price to income ratio, I think, is just terrible and we should all stop using it, right? Because 3 years ago, you could rent $1 million for $20,000 a year, right? And so the trade-off there was, well, either rent the $1 million house and pay $30,000, or I rent the $1 million through my mortgage and I pay $20,000. Well, $1 million house is cheap, right? Only cost me $20,000 to borrow the money. Now interest rates are 6%. My $1 million house to rent the money cost me $60,000 a year. And I can rent it for $30,000. Now, my $1 million house is 3 times more difficult to buy. And so if you just measure the price to income, the $1 million divided by, say, $100,000 of a household income, we've got a 10 times price to income ratio. But if interest rates are 2%, that's cheap. And if interest rates are 6%, that's expensive. Mm-hmm. Yet it's the same ratio. So, and I think you also miss a lot of other dynamics over time. You can pay more for an asset if there's lots of inflation and rents are going up, because the thing you're getting not only saves you rent this year, but it saves you maybe 30% more next year and 30% more next year. For example, if you're in Iran and it's 30% inflation, their price to income multiple is 50 times, 50, right? But that's just because they've got a lot of inflation. So if you pay that today, it'll pay itself off by avoiding those inflating rents in the next decade. So I think It's a very misleading figure. And secondly, historically, we make comparisons using individual incomes when we should be using household incomes, right? Because households buy houses, not individuals.
So if I put this on the screen right now, this is a terrace in Paddington that just sold for $9 million all over the news. I'm sure people have already seen this. You're trying to tell me this is normal, Cameron. I feel like I'm in a Ponzi market, and all I'm getting from you this morning is it's normal, Matt. Deal with it. I mean, even incomes are not right. Real incomes are not rising at the same rate as inflation, right? That's the data I'm seeing, Mr. Economist.
Well, let's dig into that one more. You've probably seen the wage price index data, right? The wage price index is like a price index, like the CPI, for the same set of jobs. What households earn as income is not the same as the wage price index, because we change different types of jobs, and we change the number of hours we work, and we change the number of people per household that work. And so because unemployment's really low, lots of people are working, self-employed people are making lots of money. All the tradies, I think in 2022-23 financial year, the sole trader sort of tradies made more than 15% extra nominal income per person that year, right? So I think it makes for great media to go, look, wage prices are 3%, inflation's 5%, ha, ha, ha. But actually, people are working different jobs, and household incomes, if you add up what the household's making nominally, they're up more like 10 to 15% per year, which is how we can get rents to go up. Rents don't go up, right, if people aren't making more money, because we're only outbidding other people.
Mm.
Now, that $9 million house, I thought that was ridiculous too, but not because it's a large number, but because there are so many other things you can invest $9 million in that I think might be lower risk, more diversified, better potential returns. But again, Charles Darwin, he noted there are fortunes made in Sydney, and there are overpriced homes everywhere. And if you're going to have a lot of rich people in your city, you're going to have expensive houses. Okay. The Reserve Bank Deputy Governor, Lucy Ellis, I think, spoke to the Housing Supply Inquiry 2 years ago, the Falinski Inquiry, and was asked, where are these examples of house prices falling from upzoning and, all these changes we think are going to happen with supply? And she said, we've never found any examples. Prices only fall when there's a macroeconomic collapse and everyone's incomes go down. That's basically, what happens. Housing and the macroeconomy are just so closely tied together. And we are in an unusual period in the cycle. I think it's also good to step back and realize that 2017 to 19 was a low point for rents and prices, and we forget it. So now when we see this rapid post-COVID adjustment, we're like, oh, record high this, record high that. Real rents in Sydney last year, adjusted for inflation, were still lower than they were in 2018, right? It's just that they had fallen nominally for a few years. We had a lot of inflation, and they were rising very quickly. So they were not record highs, but they were rising at record rates from abnormal lows. And this type of market adjustment is very disruptive, because people have relocated, moved cities based on the rent from 2 years ago, right? And now it's going up 50% in your suburb. You're like, hang on a minute, I've just moved my whole house to move to Sydney for a better life, and you're telling me that I have to pay 50% more of my rent for my rent? That's really disruptive. And so I think there's definitely things we can do to smooth out that cycle in property. But I've looked, and I just can't find places that have ever avoided it. That's just kind of what markets do.
So this is the struggle I have, a dissonance in my head, because I was a victim of these rent rises as well, and I had to move, and I moved cities, homes, suburbs. I don't understand how you can look at the data and say, clearly that's the truth. You look at the data and you see the average incomes and you see all these things that you're telling me about, that rents are returning to a normal and so on, and yet my lived experience, if I can use that work term, what I actually day-to-day experience is, hang on, my income hasn't gone up 43%, but my rent just went up 43% in one little email from the landlord. I'm like, what the hell's going on?
Yeah. So there's a mix of things. Yeah, no, incomes haven't Oh, actually, they've gone up quite a lot if you take the total household income nominally across the economy in the last 4 years. Not quite 40%, but maybe about half of that. And we also missed as a compositional shift. Remember in COVID, everyone left the cities, everyone moved to the regions, and now they're reversing. So there's a combination of two effects going on. One is the overall level of income, and the other one is people shifting back to different locations from where they were. And a lot of inner city suburbs, had rents fall 20 or 30% in Sydney and Melbourne during COVID, right? So to recover from a 30% decline, you need more than a 40% increase to get
Okay.
back to where you were. And so, yes, certain suburbs, it's been really disruptive. But if you take sort of more of an average look in the outer suburbs, where most people live, it's not as dramatic.
So when you what overall, I feel like the story you're telling me is the story of inflation. Just a constant rise in incomes, a constant rise in prices of property and other assets, and it's really just an inflation trend we're all trying to keep up with.
Well, I wouldn't say we're trying to keep up with it. I would say the same economic processes are providing more income to households. And unless we prohibit households from outbidding each other for houses and better locations and more rent, then everything moves together. So it's not exactly like there's some external force creating inflation and we try and keep up. It's just that, our incomes are also inflation. Everything's just rising. And yeah, sometimes I feel like we do miss that point, right? We look at nominal price changes all the time in housing and go, look, prices are up 200% in the last 12 years. I'm like, yeah, but that's only 40% after inflation. And then incomes went up 40% too. So what should it be? Like, tell me how they could be lower, right? Tell me how we all cooperate and not bid up prices from each other.
Well, this is, I guess, the easy general point I'm trying to establish first before a more specific one is we perceive prices going up, just the layman perceives that as an increase in value. So my income is now 180 grand, but it used to be 120 grand. I'm earning more. But in real terms, maybe I'm not, or maybe it's not much. Same with the housing. Look, I'm a millionaire now because I've got a $9 million terrace, but my parents only bought it for 800,000. But we're not actually looking at, well, this is a question to you. How much of it is illusory growth through inflation in the economy, and how much of it is real value growth, both incomes and assets?
I don't really know what real value growth sort of means economically, but yeah, mostly it's just inflation and the rising prices in the economy. There's a deviation of the asset price of homes to the low interest rate period since the 90s recession. So if you try and compare with the 80s, right, you're always going to have this weird, oh, but prices were cheap then. Oh, yeah, well, we can make prices cheap, put the interest rate up to 12%. No problem. Put the cash rate at 12%. Prices will be cheap in a couple of years. There'll be a huge recession, but they'll be cheap. So yeah, it's mostly this trend. And I think there's so to just to sidetrack on inflation, I think there is, I guess you'd call it a type of money illusion, a type of personal, what did you call it before, what the woke always say, lived experience
Yes.
point. People go, well, my wage went up. I used to be 120, now 180. That's because of me, right? That was my
I
effort.
see.
That
I see.
wasn't because of macroeconomic conditions. So you think, oh, I got that because of me, and now I have to pay these high prices because of everyone else. That's why inflation's bad, ignoring the fact that you're only getting paid more also because your wage is part of the prices in the economy. So I see that quite a lot. People go, well, I earned this pay rise and now prices are going up, and so you're making my wage less. I'm like, no, but your wage is also part of those prices that went up because of external macroeconomic conditions. So I do feel like that's a forgotten piece in the perception puzzle of inflation.
All right, so if I buy into this data-driven reality that is mostly macroeconomic forces, and we're misattributing, things like you said, like my wage rise, my more pointed question then becomes: How evenly distributed are these macroeconomic forces and inflations? Because one of my theories has always been that a lot of inflation is hidden in one particular asset class called property in Australia. So we see more inflation there than in other, whether it be equities or anywhere else. Is that the case?
No, not in the long run. So if you do multi-decade studies of the total returns to property versus other asset classes, they always even up within a decade. Because if property was making more money than other assets, people would shift into it until the return on property was the same as everything else. And so if you just stretch out your time horizon, you find that essentially all assets in the economy, if you take them categorically, obviously there's idiosyncratic risk for this property or this share, but if you take the classes as a whole, they have to basically make the same return, or there's an arbitrage opportunity, right? Everyone just shifts out of shares into property. Everyone just shifts out of property into shares. So all the long run studies show that essentially all assets track each other based on the macroeconomic conditions. Otherwise, people would switch between asset classes. So
But
no, I
there are
don't.
distortion there are distortions though, Cameron. Australia is not India, is not Canada. Is not the USA. And we love
In what way?
property, well, in the sense that we have intervention that you've described in your book, whether it be through COVID, where we protected the housing market in a
Oh,
big
yeah.
way, or if it's through policies like negative gearing, which I know accounts to a small part, as you said, but a general love affair with property and an unwillingness for our political class in Australia to change the system or to put any kind of disadvantages in there. So I feel like it's more stacked than in other countries because we have a particular fondness for property here that we're unwilling to touch.
Yeah, I think that's a common view, and it's so common that when I'm in New Zealand, they all tell me, "No, it's a particular Kiwi love affair with property here
Oh, here
that
we
makes
go.
us uniquely special." And when I was in Canada 3 weeks ago, they said, "No, this is a particularly Canadian problem. Vancouver's the worst city in the world." And when I talk to my friends in California, they go, "No, this is a particularly West Coast phenomenon, California phenomenon. We're particularly bad at this." And then I talk to students from India or Iran, and they go, "Property's fine here. You should go to India and see the crazy stuff. You think $9 million for a terrace home? Go to the fancy suburbs of Delhi or Mumbai or wherever, and compare it to the incomes of people in those cities." And then I think, oh, okay. And I used to, you know, if you read old writing of mine, I really thought there was some perverse Australian characteristic there, but oh, it's just the normal thing everywhere, and it's very hard to accept that at first, and it took me a while to just like, oh, got it. Okay, this is what property markets do. We obsess about them, especially at different points in the cycle when they're rising, and then when they're falling, we all forget about it and pretend it's not happening and cross our fingers for the next part. Yeah, it was a big, you know, it was a big mental change for me, especially since the 2000s boom. So in the 2000s boom, I was like, what's wrong with housing? Something's up. There's, yeah, it must be bad tax settings. It must be this. And in the, you know, 16 years since the 2008 crash, I've realized there was nothing special.
So
We're
propping up
just
is
like
not a. Well,
everybody else.
what about propping up then? Post GFC Obama bailouts. What about here in Australia, where the fact? I guess I'm saying asking generally, are these bailouts not distorting what you're pitching like an equilibrium natural rise? What about all of the interference?
So I think there's a political logic. So if we get away from the pure economics, because things move in cycles, there is a political logic to avoiding downturns and splashing money around, even though it's probably, you know, some people say capitalism is bad because it has booms and busts, and other people say capitalism is good because it had booms and busts, and it clears out the inefficient, terrible organizations in the bust, keeps the good ones, and you know, new people can arise in the next one. And I can be tempted either way on that argument. I see good points either way. You're right. And the US tried to avoid the financial crisis. They bailed out banks, and they didn't bail out homeowners. But prices adjusted quite quickly, and I think that helped the US economy for the last 15 years, having that big correction. Whereas in Australia, We dropped interest rates. We gave first home buyers grants. We really went hard and early. And I think we avoided the big correction. And I think it, you know, we haven't had that sort of macroeconomic, what would you call it? Freedom to start from scratch again, because we're still all holding on to these homes at the 2000s bubble prices. But everyone bails out housing. That's the other thing. Our macroeconomic stabilization, monetary policy, you could rename that house price stabilization policy, right? During COVID, first thing we did, try and bail out mortgage holders, put the interest rates down, don't let prices crash. That is part of the puzzle, because property is so intertwined with the overall macro economy. As I said, properties don't go down unless incomes fall and there's a recession. You know, those two things are separate.
Yeah. So with first-time buyers grant that you just raised, one of those distortionary factors, I thought. And then when you get Anastasia, I think it was Palaszczuk, Queensland, announcing a doubling of the first-time buyers grant, then everyone just has an extra 14 grand to go shopping with. So these are distortions in the market, right? Or are you saying they're just smoothing functions?
Yeah, I think mostly, if you zoom out through a decade-long period, now, first homeowners grants, they kind of take next year's first home buyers, they bring them into this year, they create a little blip in this bigger curve. And so, yes, there are short-term price effects, especially in the suburbs where, you know, the first home buyer grants make sense for more buyers to use. So you can definitely pull it forward. But then if you zoom out, you know, if you're not ready to buy for 5 years, 14 grand is not going to change things for you today, right? There's a finite number of those ready first-time buyers where 14 grand makes a difference. And so, yeah, we can try and engineer a little bit of blips on the upside, give them some money, try the shared equity scheme, but none of these things persist. They never last through the cycle, right? So in the 2010s, everyone was saying, oh, it's foreign buyers, right? The early 2010s, when there was an apartment construction boom in Brisbane, Sydney and Melbourne, foreign buyers are keeping prices up. Okay. Yeah, extra buyers from abroad do have price effects. They bring things forward. But then as soon as prices started falling, we said, oh, we'll bail everyone out with low interest rates. We dropped interest rates from 2017, 18, 19, 20, crashed them to zero in COVID. Well, okay, so foreign buyer effect is gone. That's now been totally overwhelmed by this low interest rate effect for everybody. So, you know, it kind of had a little blip, but then we sort of made sure everything stopped it falling and kept everything up at that level.
Do you see the same? Do you attribute the same thing to the current record immigration levels? I think it was 700,000 last year, whatever it was. But I remember seeing some data saying if we have 700,000 new people coming, we literally don't have that many new homes being built to house those 700 people.
That's right, because the biggest year in Australia is 200,000 net additional homes, and there's about 2.5 people per dwelling, so it can accommodate about 500,000 people, and that's got to obviously include new households formed from young adults in Australia.
Yep.
So, yeah, you're not going to build the 400,000 you need to accommodate 700,000 people. It's just not going to happen. We already spend, you know, 10% of the workforce is essentially involved in housing construction. We can't just go grab 10% of people from everywhere else instantly. Yep. Take them from what they're doing and put them in housing construction.
Yep.
That's just not going to happen. But you've got to remember, it's not just new homes that people move into. We can adjust the number of people per dwelling across the 11 million homes in the country, which is what we did during COVID. When the border was closed, people just spread out into all the houses that were left, right? So now the problem is, well, to get everyone to consolidate their homes, have grandma live at home, have more share houses with more people, and that takes a lot of like time, because only sort of 50 or 60,000 dwellings a month come up for rent nationally in the rental market. And so these adjustments have to happen sort of through this small doorway. And while that's happening and you've got this extra queue of foreign buyers, the rents can sort of temporarily deviate from this price to income ratio that's been pretty flat. But if I look to places, for example, like the Lismore floods, if you get rid of all the houses in a city, but everyone still wants to live there. That's the effect of a population shock, right? More people, fewer homes. And what you see in these natural disaster type areas is rents in nearby areas, they increase for a couple of years, but by the end of the third year, everything's back to normal, because that's how much time the market takes to rebuild, for people to relocate, to form different households. And so I think that's what we're seeing with the extra immigration at the moment. And I think by 2027, rents will be pretty flat, and property developers and investors will be complaining that rents aren't going up and their costs are. Right.
So the strategy,
I think that will flow through.
So strategy if you're a renter right now then is to avoid this temporary shock and wait for it to smooth out. Stay where you are rental wise if you can.
Yeah, that's exactly what I'd be doing. If I was a reasonably long term tenant, I'd be trying to really negotiate with all my best negotiating skills to say, look, I've been here a long time. It's a really risky part of the moment. If you put the rent up on a new tenant, they're not going to stay that long. It's better to go with me. I'm secure. I would definitely be doing that because I suspect there'll be quite a few parts of the country, and it's going to be different everywhere, because remember, we're readjusting back from everyone relocating with COVID. But yeah, I'd definitely be trying to stay put and try not to get caught up in moving multiple times at the moment to beat the rental market.
What do you think of the narrative floating around that the high immigration is a deliberate policy to pump up GDP and housing prices, both from a political point of view and like a personal, they don't want to see GDP go back on their watch elbow, but also to generally keep typically the boomers and the X generation, who are the ones who own the homes more so than millennials, but just to pump property prices. Is that true in any sense?
Well, what do you think, Matt? It sounds pretty plausible to me.
Oh, so you think they're deliberately keeping immigration high to keep prices and GDP high?
I think immigration has become a lever that the political class is relying on to make themselves look good based on economic signaling games. Because I find it very interesting. Look, it's honestly hard to know. Definitely from what politicians say, you've got to sort of come to that conclusion that they think this is a magic lever to keep headline number up and them looking good. But it's quite interesting that in New Zealand, Canada, the UK, everyone's had record immigration since COVID. So I think it's a combination of things. The post-COVID, I've really wanted to move to Australia, and now they've opened it up for me. So it's a combination of sort of the supply of immigrants and also the demand for them in terms of the visa settings. At the end of the day, how many people arrive is a policy choice. And I think sometimes we neglect that. And we go, oh, this is just post-COVID catch-up. I'm like, okay, yeah, but if you're driving from here to work and you went below the speed limit for a couple of kilometers, doesn't mean you can go above the speed limit, right? The next few kilometers to catch up. It's the adjustment, that speed, that is disruptive to people.
But they're doing it anyway. They're cracking in the immigration floodgates in Australia. I don't understand why you don't just put it back to 300,000 a year. Why we must push in 700,000? And then you look to the US, they've had millions, not hundreds of thousands, millions of people forcefully fought to keep the southern border open, the Biden administration. And so it's very important to them. And, some people say it's because they want to create Democrat voters. I think there's bigger issues than that.
Yeah.
It's some kind of a macroeconomic thing they're trying to pull off. What is going on?
Yeah, I don't get it. So Canada, their population is only 10 million more than us, right? 36, 37 million. And they've had a million extra people arrive in the last 12 months, right? Which is 3% population growth or something. It's almost never been seen before. And yeah, look, I don't really get it. I've been, since the big change with John Howard, I think it was after 2006, where he massively increased immigration at 200, I think the record is 300,000 in 2009 or something, but it used to be around 90, 100,000 in the 90s and early 2000s. And he massively increased it. And at that time, I said, why? Like, what's wrong with 100,000? Aren't you just making it more difficult to duplicate all the public services, duplicate all the roads, duplicate all the houses just to get everyone back where they were? Like, it's a policy choice, right? And I'm not, I think I'm the only one who thought closed borders was bad during COVID and open borders now is also bad. And that there's actually a point which gets you really good, like mixing of people moving in both directions without being overwhelming. And I don't know how to have that debate because it's also politically corrupted, I think, by various woke agendas, various political agendas, right? Talking about immigration, people still call me names on social media every day.
Xenophobic type of thing.
Because I've said, you know, there's probably a rate of immigration that is collectively optimal.
Yep.
And it's probably not what it is, 700,000 or 600,000, whatever it's going to be this year. It's probably a lot less, probably closer to 100,000 than 500,000. Why can't we have this conversation? Well, you know, it's out of control. People don't want to do it.
So
and
these
what
same...
I find funny, yeah. Sorry, just to finish,
yeah.
The Greens are the funny ones because in the 90s, they had a population policy. And they said, you know, Australia's a desert. It's a sensitive country. We need to, you know, be cautious. And they, I think they said, you know, immigration of 80,000 people or something was good. Then Pauline Hanson came on the political scene and they just took it down. We're not going to talk about this. It's too toxic. Mm. And now your modern Greens that aren't aware of that are now like open borders for all. That's the social justice way, forgetting that it's from the origin of the Greens till Pauline Hanson arrived. They were like, no, let's be cautious and balance humans and nature and development. Very interesting.
Well, consider the Greenie, where the Greenies are, like if you look at the data, they're all around inner suburban seats, right? Your roads and your what I can't even remember the Sydney suburbs, Gladesville and whatever. But if you look at big growth corridors in Sydney, Melbourne, I don't know about Brisbane, but they're all out in Penrith and Campbelltown and Oran Park in Sydney. And then in Melbourne, they're all down in the southeast, down past Clyde is the biggest booming area down that way, Cranbourne and so on. So there is a disruption in the social fabric in that sense that you've got people in Hawthorne and Toorak and Vaucluse and Newtown, Greenies, saying we need open immigration, but they're not. If you said to them, do you want to have a reduction in services, more traffic jams, your trains can't catch up for 3 or 4 years, their view might be different, but they're externalizing this immigration onto the outer suburbs.
100%. Yeah, I totally agree. There is a, you know, I know what is Rob call it, luxury beliefs thing. Like I can propose this policy because it has no effect on me. It just has negative effects on others and I can feel good about it. Rob Henderson, I don't know if you're aware of him. He's just released a book, an American writer. And you know, he's become very famous because that idea, as we can see, works in Melbourne, works in Sydney, works with population, works with so many things. And I think that's right. And I think it's just one of the many sort of signals or pieces of evidence to show that the political debates are very detached from the sort of average person, what they would want to talk about at the barbecue compared to what gets in the Sydney Morning Herald. I do feel that more and more. Maybe I'm getting old, but that's just one example. Yeah.
Okay. Then zooming out then back to my original premise for the whole interview, this idea that there's something wrong and what are we going to do about it? And you've just blown me away saying the data doesn't support that, Matt. All this kerfuffle that we're feeling. So you've pointed out that there's probably a lack of understanding, you know, like when my wage goes up, I think it's me and so on. But where is all this rage coming from? Do you think it's this... If I'm part of that minority class, you said it's a minority class who don't own their own home. It's a minority class who are suffering most and making the most noise right now. Is the stratification of those classes in Australia changing? Because that's also my perception, that we are increasing a gap and we're eroding the middle class. Has that got any rigor behind that feeling of mine?
Yeah, that's a tricky one. In terms of home ownership, I'll just give you the numbers on that. It peaked at 71.4. That's a guess. Could be 71.6% in the early 1970s. And it's sort of bounced down a little at 66.4 in the 2001 census, which is actually a slight rise from the 2016 census. So a lot of younger households aged under 45, so between 25 and 45, have caught up in terms of home ownership between 2016 and 2021. And partly it was those low interest rates that did that. So in terms of that, there hasn't been a huge amount of change in sort of the last 5 to 8 years. But I think one impression I get, and I'm just going to riff a little, is that we've got this sort of university-educated class who expected more, but is now almost the laborer of the 21st century. So people with university degrees expecting to be this elite class and live in their fancy areas, but realizing everyone's got an arts degree, everyone can do what I can do. I'm just a commodity worker in a highly educated society. And there's a bit of frustration that for example, Joe the mechanic, as
yes,
my mate
tradies.
Online, bought this house in Newtown or wherever, and now it's worth $3 million. And I got my degree from a fancy university, and I can't even live anywhere near Joe the mechanic.
Yep.
So I can see the obvious reasons for resentment of people who, I did what was right, I went to the university, I did this, and Joe the mechanic's been retired on the pension. pardon me, I'm subsidizing him, and he can live in this fancy place and I can't. I totally get that. I don't know if that's a problem. I mean, Joe the mechanic is not going to live forever and someone's going to buy his house.
Yes, but that is a reorganization of society, right? So the fact that our education centers, we've all got law. I mean, I went to law school. So, but 30 years ago, that was not the case. A whole bunch of us have these nice, fancy degrees. And you're going to push those people further out through what you've described in your book. You make choices. So you have the doctors and the lawyers who have to move slightly further out. And you'll have the plumbers and the tradies who start buying homes in Vaucluse or in the fancy suburbs of Perth. And you will have a reorganization, a geographic reorganization.
Yeah, I think that's always ongoing though, right? And I think you'll actually see that trickle back. And one of the interesting new trends that's emerging, it's happening in the US, and I think it's happening to a small degree here, is that although the government wants pretty much everyone to have a university degree, and I don't really understand this either, the target used to be 10 years ago, we want 60% of people to get a university degree. Now it's 80%. Some report came out last week. I'm like, who's going to do the actual work that doesn't need a university degree? Or are you going to have to get a degree to then go to trade school? Like, it's not clear to me that that's a good thing. But people are actually choosing to avoid university and do trades and start a business because the gains aren't as much anymore. If everyone's got a degree, your extra gains from that commitment that you're paying for, right, because it's not subsidized anymore, people making the choice and going, well, I can get a trade, become a builder, start my own business, make more money if I'm willing to do the work. And I think that's a good thing as a society to be able to run your own business, do a good job at a trade and make a great living. If you compare that to many countries where trades and manual workers are, the poorest of the poor imported from the neighboring poor countries. Like, I don't think that's a good way to organize society either. But we will adjust, is what I'm saying. People will go, well, there's no payoff from me getting an arts degree anymore. If I want to make money, I've got to do something useful for society. And if that's electrician, plumbing, builder, working in the mines, buying a farm, whatever works, getting, then that's good. I think that's good long term.
Well, Cameron, I put it to you that we are in the late stage of tertiary education in places like Australia because you're starting to see rent-seeking behavior. I mean, it's always been there. But really, the demand goes down. They're having to justify. They're playing games of moats and hedges now in tertiary education to maintain their relevance and their money.
That's true.
I'll go back to questioning. The problems we've kind of looked at now, I'm very disheartened that you're saying it's just in my head in a way. It's just cyclical. It's just shocks to the system. It's all on trend. So then my question becomes the latter part of your book when you talk about suggested changes. What would you want to change at all in a system that is so perfect in your view, Cameron?
Well, let's just say that it's not perfect. It's just doing what it normally does. Just like before we had public health care, the medical system was doing what it always did, and people would just die on the street because they couldn't get a doctor, right? And I would say that, well, this is the normal thing. What do you expect? People to just treat people for free? We can't afford it. Like, you know, we've got to change the system. And so I guess if I've looked historically, I've looked internationally, and I'm asking the question, where is the housing system better? Like, it works for most people here, but it really doesn't work for some people quite a lot of the time. And the places that work and the periods of time that work are typically those that have a large sector of non-market housing in amongst all the market housing.
Public housing.
Well, there's lots of names, public, social, subsidized, you name it. But essentially, the owner of the homes is some kind of subsidized entity, and the people who live there don't pay the market price. And either they buy it at a discount and can live forever, or trade it, or they rent at a discount and can live forever there. And so I know in the Netherlands, there were some kings hundreds of years ago who started some of these things, and they still exist today as these various housing trusts. A lot of the rebuilding after the Second World War involved public housing to some degree. And a lot of the justification at the time was, well, yeah, the private property owners could build houses, but we actually want to build so many houses so quick that it would be uneconomical for them because they would lose money. So we can't rely on the private sector to drip out property to make the most money. We're just going to do it as quickly and efficiently as we can. So the places that, you know, all these places still have this market cycle. They all complain. So there is no city on earth that doesn't complain about housing. And I think that's always good to keep in mind. But in some places, it's 60% home ownership, 30% in some kind of non-market or regulated rental situation, and only 10% exposed to the vagaries of the market, the cycle. And we have 33%. So you can solve two-thirds of the cost on renters by just shrinking that share down to 10%. And so my proposal is literally, over time, build up some kind of public parallel market, literally copy Singapore's design, which is that any resident who doesn't own property can buy a subsidized home from the public developer. They can trade it after 5 years to anyone else who qualifies. So the whole market, you know, you can trade and upgrade, but anyone who buys in that market can't own property and also qualifies for subsidized new ones. So they're not going to overbid because they can always buy the new one at a discount. And in Singapore,
how do you titrate access to that? So I know you've just come up with a solution to prevent overbidding, but there's going to be more people demanding those cheaper properties. Is it means tested? What do you do?
It's universal in Singapore. If it's oversold in certain new projects, you have a lottery. You put all your names in the barrel, pull them out. If you go in a lottery and you miss out, you get twice as many chances the next time. And if you get drawn out and you say, I don't want that house, you get half as many chances next time. But because the system is so entrenched in Singapore, 80-something% of people live in these public housing dwellings. It's literally off the plan buying, just like you would from a private developer now. You order off the plan. After a couple of years, it's all pre-sold. They build it and you move in, usually 3 to 4 years. In Australia, remember, 67% of people own their own home. They can't buy it anyway. Out of that 30% of renters, a whole bunch are not going to be ready to buy, and a whole bunch are not going to want to be that, and a whole bunch aren't residents anyway. So you've only got this sliver, and if you can ration by requiring people to be residents perhaps in that council area for 5 years before they can qualify, then they've got a really, really small pool, right? And then you can go in the lottery, and you just take a decade, and you build that up. You take 10% out of the market, so you still have 67% homeowners, you still have, you know, 17% renting, you have 10% here, or 20% renting, but you've sort of taken out this sliver of people who now are insulated the next time rents go up 50% for whatever reason in their area. And we'll still complain. The 20% of people who still rent will complain. If it's 15, they'll complain. So Poland's an interesting example. A friend of mine is Polish, and he said, well, after communism, everyone just got given their apartment, right? So home ownership, it's like 90%. And out of that, nearly everyone doesn't have a mortgage because they were just given their commie block. And only 5% rent at market rates. And he said, but market rents are still rising and those people are still complaining. It's just, if you're honest about it, you go, well, that's 1/6 of the issue it is in Australia, because we have 30%+ of people renting in the private market. They have 5%. And yes, it's still an adjustment period. It's very disruptive for them when the market does what it does. But, you know, I think the problem is smaller than when you have most people renting or more people renting.
Well, shrinking that 30% that we have, 33% we have in Australia, and getting that complaining class down sounds like a vote winner. So is there anything in this country you've seen that moves towards this kind of thing? Is there an appetite for it? Is it possible? Is it already in motion or not?
Look, there's I think talking in early 2024, there's a little bit more political appetite just because of the media attention to this issue in the last 12 months, right? It's been very, like, this has been an abnormal adjustment because we had COVID. And so the rate of change has been very rapid. So in Queensland, for example, the state government didn't want to be involved in public housing or subsidised housing. Now, all of a sudden, it's gone and bought from investment trusts vacant retirement villages, right, that were for sale by the investment fund. And so they're going to put people off the social housing waiting list in it. They've bought empty hotels that were for sale by investment funds. They've put social housing people in it. They've gone and got all these prefab homes and they've put them, you know, in Gympie and other cities and said, here you go, you can stay here for as long as you need until the market adjusts. So I think, yeah, it takes a crisis to get change. My concern is this: when rents do fall in a couple of years, we'll just wipe our hands and go, yep, everything's fixed. We'll just wait for the next cycle, right?
And how long is this cycle? Can you lay out how many years roughly? I know it might change, but you said 2 or 3 years
This? I think by 2027, our main complaint about housing will be that rents and prices are falling, not rising.
Prices as well,
okay, I
not
think
just
so.
Rents.
Yeah, by 2027, that's, you know, I put in the book, it's funny, I put in here 2026 will be the start of the next correction. If I'm right, I'm just going to tell everyone about it. If I'm wrong, you'll never hear about it again.
Failure is an orphan. Yes, success has many fathers. So how long does that cycle then last, the fall? And what type of fall? Are you talking GFC fall, when we still grew, but it went back to 1% or whatever? Or are you talking about an actual decline?
It depends what happens between now and then, I think, is the question. Because
how long?
You know, there's an appetite for buying is back this year. All my friends in property and real estate are, like, yeah, I just set a suburb record with this house I built. Crazy.
So escalating prices for another 3 years and then a downturn. But again, you're not talking crap. I know you can't predict exactly, but you're just talking a general correction. What's a correction? 10%?
Look, if I would say, let's just say prices will be below where they are today in nominal terms. So if they go up 20% from here, they'll fall 15%. They go up 10%, they might fall only 10%. So I think, yeah, that seems about right to me. I mean, they could crash majorly, right? If prices went up another 20%, and, you know, in 2 years at 5% turnover, we've got 10% of households who've bought at these high prices, paying high interest rates for 2 years. Look, it's hard to know. I think economists are either, they forget that things go in cycles, or they try and pick the timing and the amplitude too accurately. I think the general view is just remember the big picture of the cycle and keep updating as information comes in.
So big picture cycle, how long do corrections last generally? Months, a year, more?
Well, the downturn, like 3 years, and then there's usually a bit of a lull period for another 2 or 3 years. It's a sort of like a 5 or 6 year period before you get back onto a bit of a growth path.
So it's a 6 year roughly cycle all up.
Yeah. So I think if you look in the US, you talk about, let's just say, construction and prices peaked in 2005 to 2006, and then there's the share market and everything else came down with it in 2007, 2008. Yeah, by 2013, things were back on track. So 5 years after that. So, and then from 2013 to now, it's just been a straight line in the US market.
Can we go more broadly than housing using your economist hat? You're talking about cycles and us being on trend macro-wise. Is there anything you're seeing that is stepping out of trend that concerns you? I mean, money printing. I mean, I thought house prices, but maybe not. Is there anything that is deviating and you're saying this is new, this is abnormal, we need to watch it?
Yeah, I think the only thing that jumps out to me, there's a few sort of indicators showing some kind of peaks in the labor market, for example, in Canada. But I think the big macro question the next 5 years, like this next boom period, potential bust period, whatever shape that looks like, is what is happening in China, I think. Just because Australia's income from commodities is so tightly linked to Chinese real estate and Chinese capital investment. The Aussie dollar, I think, is sensitive to what's happening in Asia. Yeah, it's really hard for me to look at history and look at all the economics I've read and see, oh, have countries ever made such a huge transition economically as China and not had a huge crash? And the answer is
No,
kind of no,
they haven't had it
right?
yet, right?
Yeah, so the question is, well, what will it look like? How will it be managed? What type of things would the Communist Party do that other types of governments wouldn't do? These are all open questions, and I don't know anything about what's going to happen. I just know that it's an open question and a risk, and the next 5 year period seems like the period when there's going to be some major changes. And so that's just, if I was keeping an eye out for one unexpected macroeconomic change that seems, it's different this time. That would be the one.
What about the threat of loose? It's a typical conservative talking point, but the loose monetary supply, whether that be money printing or splashing cash or spending or just the Keynesian kind of economics. And I would also probably need to get an explainer from you on how most money printing is done through writing mortgages, not through money printers. I don't quite understand that. But yes, is there any threats there? Because I feel like we're seeing an increase in inflation and debasement of fiat in the last 10 years.
Yeah, well, we've had quite a bit of inflation for the last couple of years. If you look at it, it went like this. So cumulatively in 4 years, I don't know what it is, nearly 16, 20%. That's very real. It was very much caused by COVID. Not COVID, the disease, COVID, the panic and policy, the locking down, the giving everyone money, the everything all at once. It's sort of textbook economics in a way. Low supply, high demand, put money in people's banks. Can't keep, everyone's employed, you can't keep up, prices rise. That's correcting everywhere. I expect in the second half of this year, a lot of countries in Europe will be talking about deflation. I think that's a possibility in Europe. There's already some prints of outright deflation, like negative prices going down in aggregate on average or whatever however you describe CPI. In some countries already. So I'd be sort of keeping an eye out for that because often what you find in economics, you get this pulse, but then afterwards it's like a shadow that goes the opposite direction for a little while. We've had this inflation boom, and then maybe there'll be a little bit of a shadow
What's wrong
of
with
deflation.
deflation?
What's wrong with deflation? Nothing, anything in small amounts is fine. So a good big high-level picture of economics. Immigration in small amounts, anything less than 1%, fine. CPI, prices changing, anything up or down less than 1%, fine. If prices start falling 4 or 5%, what you find is people stop circulating the money around the economy because, well, I buy a new car next year, it'll be 5% cheaper. I'm literally making money, not spending money on cars. I don't have to do anything with it. And so when you get these big changes, either inflation or deflation, you disrupt the investment incentives in the economy. It's sort of the coordination value of prices changes and people start waiting and they're not spending. And of course, when everyone stops spending, economic activity falls. That's sort of the main issue. And I guess that's one of my concerns. If we want to drop some, clickbaity terms, Bitcoin, people go, well, it's got a fixed quantity of
21
coins,
million.
right? That's a good thing. I'm like, no, that's a bad thing. Money should expand with the size of the economy.
Only
Otherwise,
if you're talking about as a medium of exchange, right? But if you're talking about just as an increasingly valuing asset, which Bitcoin is basically a speculative asset at this point or a hedge, then
it's just
that
a bet
deflationary
against
is
other
good.
people. Yeah,
Yes,
well,
but
then that's
deflation
fine. But
is
no
good.
one's going to use it for exchange, right? Because it's a thing. You know, if I had a special type of money that increased in value 10% per year versus the money in my bank at 2%, I'm never going to spend the 10% money, am I? I'll only spend the 2% money. So I think that is the sort of, I think, early error on Bitcoin, that this would replace currency and it's this great thing to do transactions. And now it's kind of switched to, no, it's not good for transactions. We save money in it. I'm like, okay, well, you can save money in gold. Anything you want, you can buy derivatives, do whatever you feel like, that's fine. But yeah, that would be a big problem with any monetary system where you tried to fix the quantity of money, is you'd have deflation everywhere when you had growth, and it would sort of not lubricate activity. It would really grind up the gears.
Okay. Well, how overall housing is, I'm sorry to say, what it is on trend. You just got to stick with the trends. Maybe you can end with some of those predictions. You've already told us about the house prices dropping, maybe some plans for homeowners now. So we've talked about renters, might be a bit of a volatile time over the next few years and secure what you've got. For homeowners or those trying to get in, we still got a few more years of running this little boom. Would you jump in now, or would you wait for the correction in 3 years?
So that's such a tricky question, because for first home buyers, like, the actual choice of dwelling can be very important, and not all dwellings are for sale all the time. And so if you can find something today that doesn't, you know, isn't easily available, it's not some generic apartment in a generic suburb with lots of the same ones, then if you can afford it today, and remember, rents have gone up a little and they might keep going up for another year, they might not, then, you know, I don't think timing the market is as important for first home buyers who just want to live there forever. But certainly, if you were thinking, oh, it's really high, I'll never buy, I think I'd be ready in a couple of years, but prices are too high. Well, in a couple of years, I'd be checking really closely what's going on with prices and turnover and what's happening in property markets internationally, because maybe you'd want to put it off for a couple of years and not get caught at the last minute. So yeah, it's always tricky, right? Because renting is a huge liability, right? You can borrow a big mortgage now and buy a house and go, oh no, I'm stuck in this big mortgage, such an expensive liability. Well, you know, renting is a liability that's really big and it goes up without your choice quite often. So yeah, it's a real tricky one at the moment.
What do you think about my impulse that we should remove the speculative nature as much as possible from the property market? Negative gearing, things like incentives and like this, because what you just mentioned, that the value of a home is for some speculative investment, so on. But for others, it is like the first home buyer, they're looking for a place to live. But then others say, well, if you remove the on the supply side by removing incentives, you'll have fewer homes to rent and so on. But I just feel like we're making our housing market too much of a game. What do you think about my impulse to wind back some of the gamification of it, the incentive side?
I have the same impulse. Yes. And that's so, I think in terms of tax changes, one thing I think is sensible is to wind back the capital gains tax discount from 50% to, say, 25%, or to index based on input costs, simply because, you know, the negative gearing only makes sense. To make a loss this year only makes sense if you think you're going to make a gain in the future. And it makes more of a sense to make a loss now if that loss offsets your full tax rate, but the gain only comes at half your tax rate. And so I think you'll find if you tighten that up, the investors will be like, ah, it's not as great as I thought. I might have to keep it for longer. And I think that would be totally reasonable. And it might change a little bit, you know, if you think about the people buying homes as a supermarket queue. And you've got investors and first home buyers sprinkled through. It might take some investors and put them behind some first home buyers for a little while. But that'll be a small temporary effect until everything adjusts again. So yeah, I think as a tax policy, diminishing returns from flipping houses is good. As a making houses cheaper policy, don't think it's going to have a huge effect, but it may change the order of some buyers for a couple of years as everything adjusts.
If people want to get your book, The Great Housing Hijack, I should have asked this. What is the hijack? You've just told me it's all on trend. What is the hijack?
Yeah, the hijack is the state of the public debate on housing, right? The debate
Everyone's
is
using it.
hijacked. Everyone's got their interests. Oh, it's a housing crisis. Remove taxes on property because I'm a developer. There's a crisis, don't you know? Someone else, it's a crisis. Rent control, it's a crisis. Upzone, it's a crisis. I don't know. Everyone's got their thing, right? And it's so weird that we have, for example, landlords saying, oh, no, don't regulate rents because, that'll backfire and rents will go up. I'm like, hang on a minute. You make money from higher rents. And if it really backfired, wouldn't you lobby for it to get the higher rents in the future? Like, it's just everyone's got these weird stories they tell to avoid the problem of facing up to the fact that the market's doing what it does. Renters' costs are in landlords' incomes, and politically, that is a bit of a taboo topic. So the hijack is all about the cheer squad, the media saying, only looking at the extremes. Oh, suburb record here, worst suburb here, this here. I'm like, but what's happening? There's always a best suburb and a worst suburb for whatever, right? Tell me something coherent. Is it higher than it was 3 years ago? Is it lower? I don't know. But they'll never say because they want headlines. And so I zoom out and get this long run view and go, oh, it all looks pretty much on trend. Yeah, we're having an adjustment period. Yeah, during the cycle, we hit these periods from time to time. That's just not newsworthy. So that's what the hijack is.
I don't know how you're going to fling this book off the shelves then, except for those who are rational enough that want to see some data-driven, normal, rational sense making. And if that's you, the link to buy this book is in the descriptions of everywhere I'm posting this long-form interview, mainly on our website, discernible.io. Speaking of which, discernible.io, we have video hosting fees, we have server fees, we have all those things as well, and they are paid for by the supporters we have at Locals, discernible.locals.com. So if you like our stuff and you can afford it, then please go and support us to help us pay our bills there. If you like Dr. Cameron Murray, and I do, he has a think tank called Fresh Economic Thinking. He has a Substack. There's going to be a bunch of links for you to look at in this episode. And I find him a very good value follow on Twitter, on X. Is that your social platform of choice, Cameron?
That's right. That's at Dr. Cameron Murray on X/Twitter. And yeah,
All
every
linked
day
below.
I'll post something to get people thinking.
Yes, I particularly like a bit of a plug for his Twitter. I like the fact that there'll be some clickbaity news article saying, ah, and Cameron will say, okay, well, but there is some data here that shows this, and maybe it's not quite that. So I appreciate your ability to cut through the noise for me, Cameron. Thank you.
Oh. Thanks, Matt. Yeah. Well, I always enjoy your podcasts and stories as well. Thanks for having me, mate. It was really good.
Goodbye. Good luck, everyone out there buying houses.